Okay, so this workshop is Fighting the Long Defeat, Tolkien's work and witness as a Song of Hope. And so we're going to be looking at mostly the things that he wrote and some examples of the way that he brought hope and the virtue of hope to light in his writings. But I'm going to weave in some things from his own personal life and experience that will hopefully help us better understand where he was coming from and why he crafted the things that he did. I'm going to begin this afternoon with the opening section of his great work, The Silmarillion. If you haven't read The Silmarillion, I would hope that everyone would take one thing away from this workshop, and that is, read The Silmarillion. It is Tolkien's major work. That's what he thought. Himself. He did not see it come to print in his own day. His son Christopher got it out with some polishing editing work on his end. But it's the grand mythology of Middle-earth and the creation of everything that exists within his great body of mythology. And I want to begin with the creation story in the Silmarillion because of the way that it lays the foundation for everything that comes after. The creation of all things in Tolkien's mythology begins with a song. There was Eru the One who in Arda, that is the name for the created world, is called Ilúvatar, and he made first the Ainur, the Holy Ones, that were the offspring of his thought, and they were with him before aught else was made. And he spoke to them, propounding to them themes of music, and they sang before him, and he was glad. Ever as they listened, they came to deeper understanding and increased in unison and harmony. And it came to pass that Ilúvatar called together all the Ainur and declared to them a mighty theme, unfolding to them things greater and more wonderful than he had yet revealed, and the glory of its beginning and splendor of its end amazed the Ainur, so that they bowed down before Ilúvatar and were silent. He says to them, I have kindled you with the flame imperishable. Ye shall show forth your powers in adorning... Adorning the theme, each with his own thoughts and devices, if he will. So it's their job to flesh it out, to unpack it, to receive what he has said, what he has sung, and continue the song. Then the voices of the Ainur began to fashion the theme of Ilúvatar to a great music. And a sound arose of endless interchanging melodies woven in harmony that passed beyond hearing into the depths and into the heights. And the places of the dwelling of Ilúvatar were filled to overflowing. And the music and the echo of the music went out into the void. And it was not void. Then we're introduced to one of the Ainur whose name is Melkor. It came into the heart of Melkor to interweave matters of his own imagining that were not in accord with the theme of Ilúvatar, for he sought therein to increase the power and glory of the part assigned to himself. To Melkor among the Ainur had been given the greatest gifts of power and knowledge, and he had a share in all the gifts of his brethren. Some of these thoughts he now wove into his music, and straightway discord arose about him, and many that sang nigh him grew despondent, and their thought was disturbed, and their music faltered. The discord of Melkor spread ever wider and wider, and the melodies which had been heard before foundered in a sea of turbulent sound. Then Ilúvatar arose, and the Ainur perceived that he smiled, and he lifted up his left hand, and a new theme began amid the storm, like and yet unlike to the former theme, and it gathered power and had new beauty. But the discord of Melkor arose in uproar and contended with it, and again there was a war of sound more violent than before. Then Ilúvatar speaks again, Mighty are the Ainur, and mightiest among them is Melkor, but that he may know and all the Ainur that I am Ilúvatar, those things that ye have sung, I will show them forth, that ye may see what ye have done. And thou, Melkor, shalt see that no one theme may be played that hath not its uttermost source in me, nor can any alter the music in my despite. For he that attempteth this shall prove but mine instrument in the devising of things more wonderful, which he himself hath not imagined. And that is how the world is made in his mythology, and that is how the world went wrong in his mythology. So he brings in brilliantly, I think, musical themes as a way of setting the stage for all that will go wrong, because the sub-theme that Melchor brings in is discordant, it is disturbing, and notice what it did to the other Ainur. It made them despondent. It made them feel hopeless. It made them feel that the beautiful theme had been destroyed. But then Ilúvatar comes, and there's a more fundamental theme that can include the disturbing and the discordant and the despairing and charge it with hope. So there's hope for what is good and true and beautiful. But this hope in the writings of Tolkien always shines brighter and always shines brightest against the backdrop of evil and despair. You have to take evil and despair seriously before you can understand hope. One of the things I think is misunderstood a lot in our culture is that hope is not a mood. It's not, I hope that I feel hopeful at some point. I hope it just kind of comes upon me and I feel that way, but maybe I don't right now. For the Christian, hope is a virtue. It's something that has to be cultivated. It's an act of the will. It's one of the three theological virtues, faith, hope, and love. They're called the theological virtues because they require the grace of God. They cannot, other virtues, people that are not Christians can perform quite well. But these are very specific virtues that come by God's grace. It's love of God, the Blessed Trinity, who is love. It is faith in Jesus Christ, our Savior. It is hope of the blessed hope to come. And so it's an act of the will by the grace of God that propels one to have hope when the context looks as though there is no reason to hope. According to Scripture, hope is not in the modern parlance like, do you think you'll be able to go on vacation next week? I don't know, I hope so, but it may not work out, or it doesn't look like it. Hope in the Scripture is acting with absolute confidence and certainty on the promise of God, and on the character of God, and on the covenant of God, even though everything around you is not telling you that that's maybe the way it works out. Tolkien's biographer, Humphrey Carpenter, speaks of him as being a man of antithesis. He had these two poles in his own personal life of doubt and darkness and despair. And Verlyn Flieger, who was a student, she was a student of Owen Barfield's, who was a friend of Lewis's. She speaks of an oscillation between hope and despair that comes through in the diaries and in the letters and are rooted in some of the experiences that he had. Everything that Tolkien does is rooted in Beowulf. And Tolkien loved Beowulf, and the reason he loved Beowulf is it is the story of a hero fighting in the dark. If he gave the quintessential talk on Beowulf called The Monsters and the Critics. It's still in print. If you get the Norton edition of Beowulf, that's the very first article or essay that's included in the study of Beowulf. And it changed the face of Beowulf studies because people in the modern era had begun to chop things up into fragments when they did literary criticism. And so they read a work like Beowulf and they say it begins well, there's triumph over the demons, and then the hero goes down. So clearly it must have been written by two different people that were on two different projects. It can't have been written by the same guy that had an imaginative story to spin from beginning to end. And Tolkien takes issue with that. Tolkien loves the fact that Beowulf is the story of a hero fighting in the dark. But what he especially loves is there's a measure of victory, victory over the demon Grendel and over Grendel's mother that come in to harass the Golden Hall. But in the end, the hero goes down. You might do well for a while, but the dragon gets you in the end. In fact, what Tolkien says in the lecture about Beowulf is that Beowulf is a man, and that for him and for many is sufficient tragedy. Just being alive is sad. It sounds almost like an existentialist, doesn't it? Just being a man is tragic, or is imbued with tragedy, and there's no way around that. Verlyn Flieger again says, it would seem clear, however he may try to qualify the pagan point of view in Beowulf, his heart is with the tragedy. He sympathizes with the darkness. He sympathizes with the sense that there's a doom laid upon the hero, and there may be no way out for him. Tolkien was born in South Africa. His father was a banker there connected with the diamond mines. His father died while he was very young. his mother, and he didn't remember his father, but his mother was the formative person in his life. She was widowed at an early age. She had two sons. She comes back to England, and when she does so, she converts to Roman Catholicism, and she is abandoned by her family. Her family members around her were Unitarian, Baptist, and Anglican. And when I say abandoned, one of the family members at least was giving her money to sustain her as a widow. Those funds were cut off upon news that she had converted and was going to raise the sons in Roman Catholicism. Eventually, as she tried to keep things together financially, her health broke down and she died. I think she was 34. She actually had diabetes. She died in a diabetic coma. But the way Tolkien interprets the story of his mother is that she's a martyr. My own dear mother was a martyr indeed, and it is not to everybody that God grants so easy a way to his great gifts as he did to Hilary and myself, his brother Hilary, giving us a mother who killed herself with labor and trouble to ensure us keeping the faith. And this becomes the definitive thing for Tolkien. She died that we could be raised as Roman Catholics. She gave herself for this, and he really never completely recovers from this. His biographer, Humphrey Carpenter, again, says that the words I just read to you, he wrote those 9 years after his mother died, and that this stays with him, but Carpenter makes a very significant statement, that the loss of his mother had an effect upon his personality. It wasn't just definitive in some sense that it worked its way into his literary creations, but it affected his person, and he thinks specifically what it did was it made him into a pessimist. And he never felt that one could be totally full of hope all the time about everything ever again. Tolkien certainly had, although he was an introvert, he did make friends. He valued friendships. He enjoyed talking with his friends, obviously with the Inklings and others. And he certainly enjoyed talking about the things that he cared about. But Carpenter says that along with this strand of his personality, there would now be a second side, more private, but predominant in his diaries and letters. That's where this is coming from. And this side of him was capable of bouts of profound despair. If you've ever read the letters of Tolkien, which I strongly encourage you to do, they are filled with this oscillation, as Verlin Flieger says. One moment he's filled with hope, and he's writing about the way he imagines the light of the glory of God, and the next moment in another letter, he's questioning the existence of God at all. When he was in this mood, he had a deep sense of impending loss. And here's the point. Nothing was safe. Nothing would last. And then here's how he says it. No battle would be won forever. No battle would be won forever. You can win a battle for a measure of time, but you will eventually go down like Beowulf. This last statement is clearly an echo of what Galadriel says about Elrond in The Lord of the Rings. He has dwelt in the west since the days of dawn, and I have dwelt with him years uncounted, and together through ages of the world, we have fought the long defeat. And so the elves keep fighting, even though they know that they are doomed to leave Middle-earth. In his book, Orthodoxy, in a chapter called The Flag of the World, Chesterton makes the point that people talk about optimists and pessimists as if it's just two completely different people. And he says that he calls them two curious men running about when I was a boy who were called the optimist and the pessimist. I constantly use the words myself, but I cheerfully confess that I never had any very special idea of what they meant. Because the only thing which might be considered evident was that they could not mean what they said. For the ordinary verbal explanation was that the optimist thought this world as good as it could be, while the pessimist thought it as bad as it could be. And Chesterton goes on to make the point in that chapter, brilliantly, that the Christian key is the right shape that fits in the puzzle of the lock of this life, that it is filled with tremendous pain and suffering and hopelessness and despair and sin. It is truly a marred world. But at the same time, we think life has meaning. We realize, like Dr. Craig was saying today, these deeply depressed people that came to Viktor Frankl and said, and he asked them, why don't you commit suicide? There's a sense that in the midst of it all, we should be somehow fighting for the right. We should have hope. And that's the point Chesterton is trying to make. I'm going to use an illustration from the Silmarillion. It's just in a workshop it was too hard for me to go traipsing through the works of Tolkien. And one of the reasons I want to is the Silmarillion is an incredibly dark book in a lot of ways. The Lord of the Rings reads like The Hobbit compared to The Lord of the Rings. You know, you got The Hobbit as a rather cheerful, fun adventure story. You get to The Lord of the Rings and you're in deeper waters. Well, The Lord of the Rings reads like The Hobbit compared to the Silmarillion. And I find that a lot of people who have read Lord of the Rings, read The Hobbit, are unfamiliar with the Silmarillion. If you've read The Lord of the Rings, you know about Sauron the Dark Lord and all the shenanigans he gets up to. But, of course, in the larger mythology of the Silmarillion, Sauron is only the chief lieutenant of Melkor, whom we have seen in the creation of the world already, the one that brought the fundamental rebellion against Eru, against Ilúvatar. And Melkor enters into the world as this creature, Morgoth, and Sauron is essentially Morgoth's lieutenant. And so the darkness is deeper. It's more profound. We are dealing with entities that were there at the very beginning, causing the first rupture and introducing the first despairing darkness into the world. If you're familiar with The Lord of the Rings, you might look at the map in Silmarillion, and it looks vaguely familiar with the shoreline. But it's clearly a different place. And that is because by the time you get to The Lord of the Rings, you're already dealing with a broken world. A world that has been and is not anymore and never shall be again. If you come out to the west of, this is called Beleriand in the Silmarillion, and if you come across the waters far to the west, you arrive at what Tolkien called the Blessed Realm, the realm of Aman. Because in his mythology, some of the Ainur that helped with the singing of all things into being and with developing the theme that Ilúvatar had at the beginning, some of these angelic powers, as they are, became invested in the world in a permanent sense. And they are called the Valar. And if you begin reading the Silmarillion and you are familiar with Norse or Greek or Roman, the pagan pantheon, essentially, of the gods, you will recognize a number of these gods as, or these, they're not gods in his thing so much as personalized powers within the earth. But you'll recognize that they have, there's a Zeus-like character, that's Manwë, who has the eagle as his sign and sees the furthest, and then there's others that can make things grow and so on. And so he's clearly borrowed from the pagan worldview in creating his world. The Silmarillion is named for the jewels that are called the Silmarils. And this is classic Tolkien, this is classic hope and despair themes being fleshed into the fundamental story, because the elves create these beautiful jewels in the Blessed Realm. They make it to the Blessed Realm. They fashion these jewels to encapsulate, to circumscribe and capture the glory of the light of the two trees in the Blessed Realm, in paradise, in the Edenic place, if you will, and own and possess these things, right? It sounds familiar. If you're familiar with The Lord of the Rings, it was all about the ring, although that was a trick of Sauron. This wasn't intended to be a trick, but it turns out that so much of the sorrow and the destruction and the darkness and the despair of the story circles around elves and men too and Morgoth trying to capture these glorious objects. Remember when Frodo and Sam are watching the elves singing as they leave Middle-earth, and it's this sad song, and there's this sense of them leaving Middle-earth. Sometimes when I talk to people that have only read The Lord of the Rings, they tend to think of elves as these rather angelic, unfallen creatures that are all sweetness and light and don't have the flaws of human beings. But if you go back and read the Silmarillion, you find that they are capable of enormous evil. There is a long, tragic history. The elves are in exile, and they've been in exile. In fact, they are in a self-imposed exile, unlike human beings in the story. And so, a group of them have been living in the Blessed Realm, but they are led away from that when Morgoth steals the Silmarils, and they swear an oath to win them back, and they cross the terrible ice sea to the north, and they enter in, and what follows is tales of civil war and slaying and betrayal and all kinds of terrible, nasty things among the elves. And so the elves have a sad history, and it explains so much by the time you get to the Lord of the Rings that there's this tragedy that lies behind them, and they know what they are capable of, and they don't want to go back there. Tolkien had a recurring dream through his life of a massive giant wave that washed over a landmass and wiped everything away. This was a dream that he had many times over, and so he put it into the Silmarillion. The island of Numenor, where the men live, is washed away by a flood. This is the deluge, the flood myth of the story. And so men are also in exile. They are on the run. There is tragedy behind them as they move forward to eventually dwell where the elves did. In The Lord of the Rings, you're familiar with the great city of Minas Tirith, and it's already become this sort of self-enclosed tomb. It's sort of trying to preserve its history and remember things gone by. It doesn't even have a king. It only has the remembrance of a king. And this is the city of men that is saved in The Lord of the Rings. But that city is an echo of a much greater city in the Silmarillion called Gondolin. And this is the city of the elves. And this is a classic moment in Tolkien's mythology of a place that is enchanted. It's hidden from the dark powers. Morgoth can't find it. In The Lord of the Rings, Sauron is looking for the ring. In the Silmarillion, Morgoth is looking for Gondolin. And for a while, he can't find it. But even as you start reading the story, you already get a sense of what's coming up. And indeed, another tragic event. Gondolin is destroyed. And once again, the elves are on the run and are in exile. Morgoth unleashes this creature called Ungoliant in the Silmarillion. And I tell a friend of mine who's absolutely terrified of spiders that, because he hates the Shelob incident, and I say, oh, that's nothing. You need to read the Silmarillion, because that's what we need to be doing. Because Shelob is just one little spawn of this much more fundamental creature, which takes on a spider-like form, but the way I describe it to people is she is the combination of darkness and filth. And she washes over paradise, over the blessed realm, and takes down the light of the two trees and destroys paradise itself. I mean, there's just depths of darkness in the Silmarillion that are very, very deeply profound. And so as you're making your way through this mythology, you come to this one particular story that's the jewel of all the stories. Look at the way he describes his own work. Again, I'm not making this up. He himself is going to say, among the tales of sorrow and of ruin that come down to us from the darkness of those days. So there's the way it's been going so far. There are yet some in which amid weeping there is joy, and under the shadow of death, light that endures. And of these histories most fair, still in the ears of the elves, is the tale of Beren and Lúthien. So we are introduced to this character who is a mortal, a human. He is the son of Bera here. He is an heir of tragedy and sorrow himself, because Sauron discovers where Bera here is hiding out. He's a group of bandits or outlaws. You might almost think of them as Robin Hood-like men who are attacking the orcs of Sauron. And he is discovered through treachery, and he is slaughtered, and Beren happens to make it out and escape with a few men, and he is on the run. And he's sort of David-like, filled with despair. He's going nowhere. They can't get their act together anymore to fight Sauron. It's all coming down to the end. And in the midst of this, Beren meets someone, and it's transformative for his life. Beren is clearly the original of Aragorn in The Lord of the Rings, who is an echo of his story. He is also on the run and headed for better things. Beren comes stumbling into this land called Doriath, gray and bowed as with many years of woe, so great had been the torment of the road. And when he gets into the woods of Neldoreth, he came upon Lúthien, daughter of Thingol and Melian, at a time of evening under moonrise as she danced upon the unfading grass in the glades beside Esgalduin. Blue was her raiment as the unclouded heaven, but her eyes were gray as the starlit evening. Her mantle was sown with golden flowers, but her hair was as dark as the shadows of twilight. Then all memory of his pain departed from him, and he fell into an enchantment, for Luthien was the most beautiful of all the children of Ilúvatar. And so hope is born for Beren, but of course hope is elusive. She vanishes, and he begins to go in search of her. Clearly, Luthien is the original to the echo of her story, and that is Arwen, the immortal who falls in love with the mortal who seems to have no hope and is going in no direction for quite some time. Beren continues to pursue Luthien, and he finds her again in the same woods, near dawn on the eve of spring, and Luthien danced upon a green hill. And here comes one of the great themes of this story and of many of the stories in the Silmarillion. She began to sing. Song begins to go out. Keen, heart-piercing was her song, as the song of the lark that rises from the gates of night and pours its voice among the dying stars, seeing the sun behind the walls of the world. And the song of Luthien released the bonds of winter, and the frozen waters spoke, and flowers sprang from the cold earth where her feet had passed. And so he is feeling that his heart is being unfrozen and filled with hope, even as the world around him is being transformed. Luthien's father, Thingol, doesn't like men, and he wants to get rid of Beren. So he sends him on a quest. You can see it in the crown of Morgoth. The Silmarils are there in his crown that he has stolen. And Thingol sends Beren to go and find one of these Silmarils and bring it back to him, and then he can marry his daughter. Of course, thinking that he'll never see him again. And so we're introduced in this story to one of the major themes that expresses hope in Tolkien's work, and that is the idea of the quest. Beren is questing for Luthien. Luthien and Beren together are questing for the Silmaril. We see the theme of song being brought into the story, and we see the theme of starlight brought in over and over again. Remember when Galadriel gives the phial with the starlight to Frodo, that he might have hope in the darkest of times. And they're supposed to invoke Irendil, brightest of stars. If you go back into the Silmarillion, you find that this Irendil character is this half-mortal, half-elven character who's filled with hope and who sails away from the world to rediscover the Blessed Realm after it has come back. And he makes it all the way to the holy city of Valinor. This was the first thing that Tolkien wrote of his mythology. He wrote it in 1914. It was a poem. And when people asked him, who is this Irendil and what is this story about? Tolkien said, I don't know yet, but I'm going to find out. And he began putting together his mythology. So these are the expressions of hope that we find all through the Silmarillion. When you quest, you expect to find. As you quest, you sing because it is sad, but the song itself is charged with hope. Much of the time, one is singing of starlight, and starlight only shines bright because of the darkness of what lies behind the starlight. Beren joins up with one of the elven lords, Felagund, who owed his father a favor, and before they can get to Morgoth, they have to get through Sauron. And there's a fascinating event that occurs in the Silmarillion where Felagund and Sauron have a singing contest, or a war of songs with one another. Felagund strove with Sauron in songs of power. Sauron chants a song of wizardry, of piercing, opening, of treachery, revealing, uncovering, betraying. And Felagund responds, swaying. He sang in answer a song of staying, but Sauron had the mastery. And so what we're seeing there is an echo of what happened at the creation of the world, where Melkor brought in the song, and Ilúvatar's song strove with the song of Melkor. Felagund and Beren are captured, they're thrown into a dungeon, their comrades are all eaten by a werewolf. Thingol tries to keep Luthien from going to save Beren, but Rapunzel-like, she comes down from her prison, and she comes to where Sauron's tower is in the Isle, and as she gets there, she begins to sing a song, and it's a song that no walls of stone can hinder. And so her song goes out. Beren hears her song, and notice the starlight and the song coming together. The stars shone above him, and in the trees, nightingales were singing. So hope is reborn. he answers with a song, and he answers with a song in praise of the starlight. Luthien hears his voice and sings a song of greater power. And so there's this antiphonal singing back and forth. At one point in the story, just before they go up against Morgoth, they're separated. And Beren is alone again. He's left Luthien behind because he doesn't want her to be harmed. And as he goes up against Morgoth, he sings this beautiful song. Farewell, sweet earth and northern sky, forever blessed, since here did lie, and here with lissome limbs did run, beneath the moon, beneath the sun, Luthien Tenuviel, more fair than mortal tongue can tell. Though all to ruin fell the world, and were dissolved and backward hurled, unmade into the old abyss, yet were its making good for this. The dusk, the dawn, the earth, the sea, that Luthien for a time should be. He doesn't know that she can hear the song because she has arrived. She's caught up with him again, and she begins to sing in answer as she faces the darkness. Keep reading the story and discover whether you think it ends well or not. Of course, Luthien is in the primary world too. Edith Bratt was the young lady that Tolkien fell in love with. He was under the charge of Father Francis Morgan for a time, and he was placed in this home to live with somebody because he was an orphan, and Edith was an orphan too, and what began as a friendship blossomed into romance, but it was a forbidden romance. Father Morgan was very upset about this because she was 3 years older than Tolkien, and because he was desperately trying to get Tolkien to buckle down and do his studies and pass the exams to get into Oxford, because if you don't get a scholarship in Oxford, he wasn't going to get it. He didn't have any money. And so they are separated for a lengthy amount of time, for 3 years. It's a dark time. In his diaries, he's writing of the utter hopelessness of it all. Then when he does finally get back with her, he discovers that she has been engaged to another man. And it's one of the most astonishing parts of his entire life, because they've grown apart, they don't know each other anymore, his guardian is against it, and she's engaged to another man, and Tolkien says, I think I'm going to pursue her anyway, and going to win her hand in marriage. And he does. On their tombstones, she is Luthien, and he is Beren. I'm going to skip through some of this because I'm running out of time, but suffice it to say, Beren and Luthien do make it up to the terrible place where Morgoth has his fortress, and she comes to Morgoth and begins to sing a song of such surpassing loveliness and of such blinding power that he's forced to listen, and a blindness came upon him. The darkness is undone because of the hope. And so if Tolkien brings questing and starlight and song in as the themes of hope in his work, he understands that the very form of fantasy itself has a sense of escape and of what he called eucatastrophe. He didn't like when people looked with scorn on the word escape and talked about fantasy as being escapism, because he said if a man is in prison, doesn't he try to escape and go home? Or if a man is in prison, doesn't he want to talk at least about other topics than jailers and prison walls? And aren't we in a kind of prison? And isn't there an escape into another world that helps us come back into this world and be filled with hope and understand it better? Deep within the stories, of course, is this whole idea of the twist, not ending, but just the twist in the plot. A good catastrophe, a turn, a glimpse of joy, joy beyond the walls of the world, poignant as grief. Like when Frodo and Sam reach Mount Doom. And Tolkien believed very strongly that the gospel shouldn't abrogate our love of legend and mythology, but that they've been hallowed by the happy ending, because the gospel contains a fairy story. And within the gospel is the greatest and most conceivable eucatastrophe, the sudden good surprise as opposed to the sudden dark surprise. And the birth of Christ is the eucatastrophe of man's history. Man's history is headed down. It's circling the drain, and then there's eucatastrophe. God becomes a man. Then in the story of the God-man, there is the murder of the very Son of God and the rejection of Him on the cross. But then there's the eucatastrophe, the sudden turn of the resurrection. And so the gospel story begins and ends with joy. It's the gospel that is the great eucatastrophe, with this difference, that it's entered history, it's entered the primary world. And so in light of the good news, Tolkien says in his excellent essay on fairy stories, that what the Christian is compelled to do in light of the gospel is he still has to work with mind as well as body. We still have to suffer and hope and die, yes. But we may now perceive that all our bents and faculties have a purpose which can be redeemed. In the later part of his life, Tolkien was doing well. The Lord of the Rings did well. He got to retire early. But he was given to terrible moments of despair and gloom and depression, deeper than he'd ever known in any other part of his life. Part of it was because he couldn't finish anything that he started. He found himself filled with anxiety and procrastination and depression. And so many of the great things that he wrote, including the Silmarillion, were not finished. I'll close with this. It was in light of this context that he writes to his son Michael, his second son. And he tells him that out of the darkness of my life, so much frustrated, I put before you the one great thing to love on earth, the Blessed Sacrament. There you will find romance and glory and honor and fidelity and the true way of all your loves upon earth. But more than that, you will find death. And he means like C.S. Lewis means, good death. The death of that which cannot survive in order to achieve what can survive. Tolkien saw in the Eucharist the themes that he had put into his story. That the Eucharist is the sign of eucatastrophe. You come to a feast about a broken body and spilled blood and death and tragedy and fall. And yet, that's the sudden turn of the gospel. And so we are pursuing the presence of God. We are singing along the pathway of pilgrimage through the veil of tears. And we have this star by which to navigate, the hope of the gospel. And the Eucharist is a foretaste. It's the light of the future glory breaking through into this light. And that is the way that we participate here and now in the good news. All right, I'm going to stop there. And I'll entertain any questions, and we'll draw some names. Yes?
Do you kind of picture, this is another part of the thing, I think that before the darkness of his personality,
yeah.
At the end of the day, you always brought it back.
Right. Except in the Silmarillion, many hopeless stories are given. There's no good ending to many of them. If all your major characters die, and they die in the most hopeless ways, enslaved in a pit, and the story does not end well for everyone. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
The majority of the elves that suffered this day were of the descendants of the Noldor. They were cursed purely by the fame of pride and him alone.
Right.
But after his sin, he sworn all of himself and his son that every bloodline, or everyone in his bloodline, could see
right.
Whether they wanted to or not.
And you see the doom of that working its way out through the story. Right, right. 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 Yeah, it's embedded within the story in a different key, if you will. It's in the key of mythology, and it's very clearly a fall story followed by another fall story and another fall. You know, because he doesn't go into the men as much, but he says that the men turned before they even met the elves. I think they turned to serve Morgoth, so they had their fall. So the elves have the fall. They have the fall. One of the Valar has fallen. You know, or one of the Ainur are fallen. You know, so. In each race, there's this. The dwarves start out falling. They're pretty messed up from the beginning. But yeah. So there's, as you say, there's all of these fall stories that are built into the. Yeah. All right. I'm going to draw a name, and that person can come and choose. Alan Metzger. All right. Big shocker there. I love the illustrations of Ted Nasmith very, very much. Better than Alan Howes or what's his name, John Lee even. Although I like theirs. Ted Nasmith has just remarkable vision of Middle Earth and what it looks like. John Hensley. No. Although it should be, because that's what happens in the, you know, the Middle Earth. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You think you've gotten this wonderful treasure, and then somebody rips it away from you. Yeah, that's a good point, yeah. Absolutely. All right, we have the Beowulf translation. I haven't even gotten to read this yet. I'm really excited about it. So, no, I have my own copy, so I don't need to win it. Jody Vinson, am I saying that right? All right. There you are. You're welcome. How many here have read the Silmarillion? Oh, a number of you. Awesome. Great. Okay, yeah. It's a lot of people find it very off-putting and difficult, but I just love it because it has such a high tone to it, too. You know, The Lord of the Rings begins a bit like The Hobbit, and then it rises up in its tone. But The Silmarillion starts up here.
Why do you think he wrote, you know, The Hobbit as he did Lord of the Rings and did The Silmarillion? Like, was The Hobbit supposed to be for kids, or why didn't he have a light-hearted tone?
Yeah, you know, he tried to rewrite The Hobbit at one point because he didn't like the tone. He had written it to be a children's story, and then he changed his mind, as he did with everything, and decided that a children's book shouldn't be in a different tone. It should be. But when he tried to rewrite it, it's my understanding that he just didn't think it was The Hobbit anymore. It had already kind of become... Lewis and he both had this sense that even after you write something that's your own, it sort of becomes objective. It becomes something apart from you, and you don't keep tinkering with it. Then he starts writing, you know, a sequel to it, and of course it didn't take him long to realize this isn't going to be a sequel to The Hobbit. It's going to be another, I mean it is, but it's really going to be its own story and written in its own tone. And a lot of people critiqued that when it came out and didn't like The Lord of the Rings for that reason. So he caught a lot of heat that this is a different, completely different tone than, you know. So it was kind of the development of his writing. I think The Hobbit was just... Some of you probably know better than I do. I'm trying to remember. I'm not even sure how clearly in his mind The Hobbit was part of the bigger mythology yet.
Initially it wasn't.
Yeah.
Was it his first one?
I don't think so. I mean, it was his first of the three. Yeah, I mean, he'd been writing parts of the Silmarillion. Yeah. Which he never finished. But that was his first major, yes, work of the three that came out, right.
There are all kinds of mechanisms in the Hobbit, like pocket watches and
yes.
Flashes and things that he
right.
Put in if he realized this is going to be
that's right.
The mythology
yeah.
Of
yeah. And of course, being the guy that he was, I mean, like, okay, in my last workshop on this, somebody said, made me very happy, they said, the story of Beren and Lúthien, it's told in prose in the Silmarillion, but in the Lay of Lathian, it's told in poetic form. And this person said, and it's the greatest poem, narrative poem ever written in the English language. And I said, yes, but of course it's not finished. So you feel full of despair even as you're reading it, because you are reading that which has no conclusion. And it's like that with so many. I remember feeling like such an idiot I was on a plane once, and I was reading the unfinished tales of his that they've collected. And, you know, I'm reading away, and I get so caught up in the story, I forgot what I was reading. And, of course, the story just stops, and there's no conclusion. And then you shut the book and go, I'm reading a book called The Unfinished Tales, right? So, I mean, it's not really like I didn't know what I was in for. But there is that sense of sadness looming over the works of Tolkien. And the longer time went on, the more he disliked his own stuff and other people's stuff. And it's just kind of the way he was. Yeah.
Characters, and every one of them is clearly distinct in style and
yep.
power, if you will, from
yeah.
the characters. You want, instead of the holidays, a standalone story, tied into Lorgan's, but Lorgan's a standalone story apart from Silmarillion.
Right. It's really true, and people get quite a shock when they go from one to the other, especially if they go to the Silmarillion. Like if you read The Hobbit and then said, I'm going to read the backstory here, and then you turn to the Silmarillion, there would be some major surprises for you there. And I have friends that, I mean, I have a good friend. He's my former priest from years ago, and he hates the Silmarillion, and he's always telling me that you don't need to read that bilge, you know, you can just read The Lord of the Rings and it's good enough on its own. And I'm just like, I don't even want to talk to you anymore. So he's always telling me about all the theological heresies in the Silmarillion, and I'm like, oh, come on, you know. So, but not everyone likes it, and those who like some of the other works have a real problem with it. So, yeah. They are. They're also a kind of an ignorant race. And maybe that's why they're so happy. Because they don't really know. They don't know the stories. They have their own stories. And their story, there's some moments, but there's not the depth of despair in their stories. And you know, like that, when you're early into The Lord of the Rings, you're reading and Frodo begins to hear and Sam about the terrible Dark Lord. And I mean, it's just like this brand new information to them. And it's just horrendously, despairing. But that seems to be their first introduction to the big picture. And so, yeah, they are happy. And, you know, Tolkien said that he was a hobbit in everything but size, but not so sure about that.
Yeah.
So... did somebody over here?
Yeah, I have a question. Do you know of any ways that Tolkien's fidelity to the Roman Catholic Church went beyond just the emotional sacrifice of his mother? Like, did he have strong theological reasons for why is the Roman Catholic and not the Roman Catholic incredibly great?
That's a difficult question for me to answer because I'm really not sure. I think that it's pretty obvious that, you know, like some people, like his own biographer Carpenter, will just come right out and say that the Roman Catholic Church replaced his mother in his emotional life. You try to find out if there was something more to it than that. I think there had to have been. The reason I think so is because he was very faithful in his life on a regular basis, participating in the faith in which he was raised. Edith, not so much. She wasn't attuned to it. Very later in life, she was more comfortable with it. But early on, she had a very, very difficult time in the whole conversion process. So, I would say, I mean, I assume yes. I assume yes, he did, you know. But I have to say that the criticisms that he levels against other traditions isn't... isn't really spot on theologically. Some of the things he says, I just don't think are factual. And so, I think, you know, I'm not sure how much of it was a real theological, because he didn't reject one thing to go to the other. He had been taken into it as a young child. Yeah, so, right. All right, thank you all for coming. Enjoy it. Very possible, yeah. Very possible, yeah. Yeah. I wonder about that a lot. Right. Right. And he was your typical introvert in the sense that he wants to get away from the company of others because it makes him depressed. And he goes off by himself. Right. It's not a negative thing, but in going away from people, he becomes even more depressed.
Right. Well,
so, right.